Welcome to Extroverted Developer, a podcast about computer programming and technology in New York City. I'm Jim Wallace.
And I'm Ben Gunderson.
And today we have a special guest, Brian Guthrie. Is that how you pronounce your name?
Guthrie.
Oh, just like Scott Goo.
Yeah,
Scott Guthrie. No relation?
No relation.
No, not as far as I know. And unfortunately, no relation to Woody or all or other.
Okay.
Which is out of
line. Fair enough.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and your background. This is just your first time on the show.
Sure. Thanks for having me on. I'm really excited to be here. So I work for a company called ThoughtWorks. ThoughtWorks is an IT consultancy. They do a lot of work sort of in the agile space. They employ Martin Fowler as their chief scientist. He was one of the early signatories of the Agile Manifesto. And ThoughtWorks is about 2,000 people worldwide, founded in, 97, I think, something like that. And so I worked for them for a number of years up until December, and then I quit ThoughtWorks in December to go join an old colleague of mine at his startup in Y Combinator. And I did that for a couple of months, which was fascinating. The relationship didn't work out between us, unfortunately. And so I ended up coming back to ThoughtWorks because I like New York, and I basically like ThoughtWorks. They're good people and very, very smart.
Yeah, it seems like a really smart place to live. Martin Fowler is probably one of the most influential bloggers in the industry, for sure. But today we're here to talk to you about your opinions and things, of which you have many.
I do. I'm well known for my unreasonable number of opinions, I think. So,
okay. Well, let's talk about a couple of things that happened this week. Khan Academy announced that they're launching a computer science program that allows people to learn computer science for free online, just like the rest of Khan Academy with their videos online. Right. But I think they've taken a really unique approach to this.
Well, they'd actually had computer science before this. This isn't their launch of computer science as a discipline. It's their launch of this new platform for teaching it, like a whole new interactive
right.
JavaScript thing.
My understanding from reading the blog article and stuff is that this is based on a video from, I can't remember the guy's name. Inventing on Principle is the name of the video. I'll put the link to that and the guy's name in the show notes. Which is actually, if you have about an hour's worth of time, you should go watch that. It is inspiring for sure. And the basic premise of the Inventing on Principle thing is that he thinks that he has a principle, and his principle is that creators of any type require real-time feedback on what they're doing. And so there's many ways in which programming is not a real-time thing, right? We type into a text editor, we click save, right. And then we have to go and compile it as a separate step. Now, IDEs try to make that more of a real-time feedback. Visual Studio has nice little red squigglies underneath your code whenever you save, and it doesn't quite check out. But that's not quite as...
A name for the... I wish I remembered the acronym for it. It's a real-time execution loop. Which is really useful for learning a language if you can just type into it and get instant feedback. Code Academy has something similar to this, and every browser has this built in for JavaScript.
Yeah, absolutely. And what this guy was saying is that the people who do best in computer science are the ones who are good at playing computer in their head, which is the people who can read the code and pretend to be the computer executing those lines of code in order to understand what they do. And so they keep it all in their head. And as soon as I heard that, that rang immediately true to me. I don't know how you guys feel about that.
I guess I buy that. My first reaction to the computer science module on Khan Academy, I guess, is it computer science? And maybe that's a too fine a distinction to worry too much about. But it feels like they're going into the same space that companies like Codecademy and RubyMonk are doing. And I guess I didn't follow it deep enough to see where it transitions into the more traditional computer science aspect. But I don't know, is what they're teaching computer science, or are they teaching programming, or is there a meaningful distinction?
So they do get to the computer science part, I guess let's call it theory and practice as sort of two separate things, because I do think they are in some way different, in the same way that physics is different from mechanical engineering, right?
Sure. They're
different disciplines.
Computer engineering and computer science.
Unfortunately, the computer engineering term has been bastardized. I'm not actually sure that anything outside. So John Carmack, 2 weeks ago in his keynote presentation, said that there's no science in what we do in programming except algorithms. That is real science because you can measure, you can benchmark, and then you can fine-tune and prove that your code is faster or better in some way for doing things. But outside of that, most of what computer programmers do is flowcharts.
Business process modeling, I guess.
Business process modeling, that's definitely what I do.
Yeah. And then application design, which is definitely not computer science.
And so the things that Khan Academy is teaching are they're using a media model where you get the immediate feedback and you... you're doing things on the screen, and they change in real time as you are typing out code and commands. But if you want to understand more about the particular task that you're doing and how it relates to computer science, there are links to deeper stuff for when you're ready. So it's not forced upon you. You don't have to go in and learn that theory and learn that computer science underneath like you would if you were getting a degree from a university. And maybe that's good, maybe it's bad, I don't know. It's probably good for the kids that do go in and continue to click and learn that stuff on their own. I'm actually super jealous of everyone and their opportunities for self-learning.
Kids these days.
So I learned originally in a really interactive environment, which was used to be called Dr. Scheme, and that was put together by the programming language team, which is a group of computer science academics, some of the same people responsible for the book The Little Schemer. Mm-hmm. And that's all now become Racket and the program environment Dr. Racket. And the goal there, I think, was twofold. One is that they sort of they built a subset of Scheme that was simplified for student use, mm-hmm. that ironed out a lot of the things that are very relevant to professional programmers but maybe less relevant to students, which I think is one of the places in which trying to teach students through JavaScript might people might struggle with it, I guess.
Right, because JavaScript has so many gotchas.
Right, so many warts. And the other piece is that it allowed you to sort of connect the pieces of the program together. So it was a very graphic, visual debugging tool, and of course a REPL built in as well. Mm-hmm. And that was a really neat kind of environment. And I think that this notion that you can teach people by connecting these things together is really great. I found it frustrating as a student a little bit because they did a really similar thing that the Khan Academy exercises do, which is to give you kind of a pure code playground and then connect that to a GUI running somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And then you get to tweak the inputs into the GUI and use that to sort of model your understanding of it. And I always found it to be a kind of frustrating experience because I wanted to know how to build the GUI. I mean, that to me was the interesting part. It was painting something that a user could interact with and the function that underlaid it that allowed you to build a calculator or whatever was sort of, you know, very mechanical.
So let me guess, you're anti-frameworks as well.
not necessarily. it depends on the job, I guess. But what sold me a little bit on the Khan Academy thing, did you actually go and click play on any of them and run through the exercises?
I did not. I just read everything on the screen.
No, I didn't either. Yeah, I just looked through and I read his blog post. But
it starts off as really unstructured. You just sort of get code on the left, I think, and you get the diagram on the right, and you can kind of tweak the code and see how the diagram changes.
Right, they've got little sliders and things, different ways of interacting with the code.
But when you actually run through the lectures, I thought that's really when it shone. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the implementation was, but they kind of integrated the classic Khan Academy informal style of scribbles on the screen and sort of an informal style of presentation. And the lecturer, a woman, sort of leads student through starting from nothing and building up from there. And you can see how things change on the right and sort of scribbling and drawing funny faces. Like, it was a really nice, gentle introduction. And that made a lot more sense to me than, you know, here's a playground. Go write some code. Because the one thing I was expecting out of it and didn't see immediately was where are the exercises, which is what places like Code Academy gives you.
Right, exactly. You know, I think that... do you think that style of teaching is going to actually bring more people into computer science? We constantly say that there's not enough computer science graduates and there's not enough engineering and stuff like this.
There needs to be more like youth learning and stuff bringing it
and
to...
And more women, possibly.
And more women.
Right.
Yeah. And everyone's tried their own style of kind of a GUI-based editor. Like Google App Inventor had the puzzle pieces that you put together that only fit together if the grammar structure was right. And,
yeah.
I don't know. If this is a problem that can be easily solved for general.
Right. I mean, IDEs and programming environments geared towards learners are not new, right? I mean, you go all the way back to Logo Writer, which I remember using as a kid on the Apple IIe.
You guys remember? How do you move the turtle?
The turtle.
Yeah. I remember hearing later, Logo is actually a functional programming language.
Hmm.
There are no modifiable state in it. That's kind of cool. But I don't know. I mean, it hasn't helped before, right?
Nothing anybody has done has gotten more women or more engineers to be actually graduated.
And, you know, even the program I went through with its emphasis on pedagogy and bringing people into the sphere was still quite rigorous. I mean, I like to hope so, right? I think they wanted to use that as a way to get people up to a certain point as quickly as possible so you could start studying the interesting stuff. Mm-hmm. Or at least their definition of the interesting stuff, right? So you go in and you start writing scheme interpreters and things like that. But, you know, I don't know. I don't know that our freshman class had a higher success rate than any others. I'm sure they could speak to that better than I could. But
it seems like the only thing I know of that has gotten more people interested in community programming, and I believe we bring this up almost every week, is games.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Right.
There's always something. So when I was growing up, I had the luxury of, I was into computers and none of my friends were, because computers were still for nerds, until MP3. And then MP3 suddenly, when they could get free music, right, they wanted to know how computers worked. They wanted to know how the internet worked, because an IRC is how you used to have to go get MP3s back in the day.
Yeah. Winamp, man. It would be mama's us.
Yeah.
So really nice.
Also, being sort of generally rebellious and hacking and breaking into things has also driven a lot of... Yeah.
That's so funny. I got a phone call from somebody trying to social engineer me like 10 minutes before the show started, claiming to be from Microsoft.
Oh. How far did they get?
They got really mad at me.
Oh,
wow. Nice. That's good. That's the way to do it.
Yeah, I was trying to waste their time. Like, oh, my God, really? What's wrong with my computer?
Oh, gosh, did you ever see that site? The guy who used to troll the Nigerian email scammers?
The 311 scammers. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, so good. And it's like, it made the dude carve a wooden keyboard, I think, was one of those pictures.
Those are brilliant.
They were on the news for a while. So I think that the stuff with the principled learning stuff and the immediate feedback, luckily that video was very inspiring, and it actually has even inspired me. So I'm big on developer tools. I worked in Visual Studio, and I had kind of let it go for 4 years or something. Programming a plugin for Visual Studio is not straightforward, even when you're familiar with the API. It's getting better. Visual Studio 2012 was just released this week, and their plugin architecture seems to be much better. I'm just playing with it now. But I've come to this realization that there's a lot of things that developers do that break our tools. And one of them is polyglot, right? Like just being in multiple languages. Like we've got Python processes over there.
Right.
We've got C++ processes over here. And in order to communicate between them, we have a messaging layer, right? Mm. But no IDE really understands go to definition on a message. What I mean is, where the hell does that message go?
Right, where does it end up?
Exactly. But I suspect that people at most of their workplaces, they do know, right? They pull up the little mapping file, or they pull up the interface or something like that. And you have to step through several files in order to finally get to the function that handles that message on the other side. And I'm realizing that you could actually automate this. Like you've basically defined your own domain-specific language in the way that you send messages in your organization and how you handle reception of those messages in your organization. And you can program the go to this file, look up this, go to that file, look up this part automatically. And so sure enough, I did that. It took me a couple hours in Sublime to write some Python code to give me a new version of go to definition that
would
take a regex and match on a string, like for a database call that we have, we call into a stored procedure, and I want to see the stored procedure code.
Yeah.
I've hard-coded the path to those stored SQL stored procedure files, right? And that's actually fine. You don't have to solve the general case when you're making IDE tools for yourself. But the experience of this is so much better for that 2 hours of work. And so I highly recommend people start looking again at extending their IDEs for their specific daily tasks.
I mean, the trouble is that stuff can become yak-shaving so easily. Mm-hmm. Right? You follow a path that seems to... like it'll lead towards a more rich development experience, mm-hmm. And before you know it, you're neck deep in yak hair trying to figure out how you got here, right? And I don't know. I mean, Fred Brooks talks about this stuff, right? He talks about the tool maker as being part of an experienced dev team. Like you've sort of senior architect who writes most of the production code, and the apprentice, and sort of the tool maker who lurks in the background and just facilitates everyone else's work.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always thought that was a fascinating idea. In practice, I haven't been on that many teams who felt like they were able to justify carrying through the work into something that was cool. But I agree, we should do it more often.
I think so. Sublime actually makes it super easy.
Yeah,
it's just Python built in. Their API is really straightforward.
Yeah.
People at Microsoft, pay attention.
Really,
Kevin, I know you listen.
I definitely come from the. So I do most of my work professionally in Ruby. And culturally, I come from the find the best text editor you possibly can and find the best plugins and go for it from there rather than moving towards an IDE. And I've tried some of the Ruby IDEs, and they make a valiant effort, but none of them has yet to replace sort of the core desire to just find the best raw text editing tool I can. And right now, that's Sublime for me. I think it's a wonderful...
So you were a Vim user before that?
I was, yeah.
Yeah.
And I've bounced back and forth between Vim and TextMate and Sublime and a couple other things. I've never quite made it into Emacs. It's on the list for one of these days.
I think there's two types of people, Vim people and Emacs people.
Some people would say Emacs is a step backward from that. I'm a Vim guy now, but primarily my IDE is almost entirely... really the browser, right? I mean,
browser, JavaScript.
The browser is where you put in breakpoints. The browser is where all your watch expressions, Chrome plus a few plugins is an amazing IDE.
Do you unit test your JavaScript?
Not really.
Okay.
We don't have a good framework for that, so I have to write my own
to some extent.
But that's when I have the time.
That's interesting. Rarely. What made you decide to switch to Vim?
I guess as any kind of end-to-end guy who has to deal with the server on a regular basis, I'd always kind of known how to use VI.
Right.
And one day I was like, I should just get a lot better at this, so I'm going to make myself use it for a month. Mm-hmm. And I used it for a month, and then I just never stopped.
Yeah, whenever you have to log into the edit a file on the,
right,
the production
exactly.
server.
It's a,
all the time.
And so I knew all the basics of it. And then I was like, I've heard this could be a lot more powerful. I'm much more interested. And this coincided with me switching to a Mac from... a PC.
So that's right. You bought your MacBook Air,
right? I have a MacBook Air, and I have
photos. We can add them to the show notes.
Right. And I have the iMac at work, and so everything is now Vim, and I love it.
The reason I went from Vim to Sublime is because of what you're saying. I was using Windows at work and a Mac at home, and then Linux when I was at Citymaps. And Sublime is a consistent editing experience across all of them.
Yeah, I was
Vim,
in the same boat
so
when I picked it up last year.
Yeah.
Exact same thing.
Yeah, now MVim is my standard
MacVim
crossover.
Yeah.
Yeah, MacVim.
I mean, my other complaint, besides the cross-platform stuff, my other complaint or frustration with Vim is that it can be a very good project-level editor after you've installed about 8,000 plugins.
Yeah.
And it still feels like... I love all the community around Vim, the fact that people are so actively developing these things, but it still feels like no one's quite agreed upon a stable set of these things.
Right.
And some of them seem relatively standard, at least they were the last time I checked in. I guess, is NerdTree still the go-to... file browser plugin, or
I have no idea.
Maybe
I should look into that.
People are using Fuzzy Find a lot more now. So,
NerdTree, Command T before that, I guess, right? Okay, and I don't want to have to go through that kind of churn. I mean, I like that Sublime provides a file browser out of the box. It provides file location out of the box. Command T style stuff.
I thought it was so clever when I got Vim to work with Pathogen, which allows you to have Git submodules be your plugins.
Oh, yeah.
And so
yeah.
I just have a GitHub project that is all of my Vim plugins, and whenever I go onto a new box, I just clone that down and install Pathogen, and it will set up a Vim in my environment settings. But that functionality is built into Sublime with package control.
Yeah, which is a lovely... Again, package control is just a really wonderful enabler for plugin install. And I have this fantasy that I'll get really deep into Sublime text customization one of these days. And I like knowing that if I do, I'll have Python there sort of underneath the covers. It's not my go-to everyday language, but it's a perfectly nice language. Unlike VimScript, which from what I gather is sort of a horrible aberration.
Yeah, it seems patched together as opposed to well thought out, whereas these guys are just using Python. Whenever you get a package, the source code is all available to you. So if you're like, oh, that's cool. How did they do that? Great. Go to definition. Actually, Sublime Code Intelligence is the plugin I use for Go to Definition on Python, and it is the best Python Go to Definition I've ever seen. I'm very impressed, considering the dynamic nature of the language.
Nice.
Python reading Python, man. It's crazy.
So meta.
So as far as language or programming sort of teaching popularity goes, if I could return to an earlier thread, I guess the last thing, this resonated with me with video games. I grew up playing video games as well. Mm-hmm. I think what gets people into it more than anything else is the reason why anyone chooses a career to some degree is it has to be cool. Like you have to be able to walk away and tell your friends that you know, you're doing something that's enjoyable or that has an impact on the world. And I think that startups are playing some of that role now. Not everyone feels like they can go all the way in games, but the popularity and prevalence of startups are bringing more people into the fold. And the prevailing advice that non-programmers are now receiving isn't go find a programmer, it's learn to code yourself. And that's, yeah, I think, right, bringing a lot of people in who wouldn't normally get there or who might normally be intimidated. And there's been a big community push for bringing people in and tutoring people on the weekends. And I know that there are women's hacker groups here in New York City. My friend Rachel Ober runs one for women who are Ruby hackers. And you know, I think
there's hackers office hours and things like that. It seems like the absolutely. Ruby community is much bigger on that than any other community. Right. So that's very impressive.
Ruby community is weird. Like it's in many ways it's really wonderful and inclusive. And I love a lot of things about it. I love the focus on clean code and a lot of people in it seem really friendly. But you also have this weird sort of undercurrent of you're doing it wrong and I don't know, sort of the DHH style, very aggressive conception of what it is to be a Rubyist. Mm-hmm. And it's weird that you have both of these extremes. And it feels like the core of the community is, you know, I would like to count myself in that to some degree. I've spoken at Ruby conferences before. I wouldn't do it if I didn't like the people there. But it does seem like there's a thread that runs through it that's a little bit more dogmatic. Mm-hmm. And it's not that they're wrong. There are ways to abuse Ruby. And the core group of Rubyists discovered years ago what those bad ways were. And part of their, irritation is that other people are stumbling into dumb stuff like method missing all the time. You know, it's never been particularly good idiomatic uses to pull out method missing. Just because it's there doesn't mean it's a brilliant idea.
Mm-hmm. So I'll explain what you mean for that, or you can correct me. Method missing is this: whenever you type something into Ruby and it doesn't have that function call, you can override this thing called method missing, and that'll essentially allows you to turn Ruby into your own domain-specific language very easily.
Right.
Which is also very dangerous.
It's mind-blowingly awesome if you haven't seen it before, right? Because Ruby's a small talk style OO language, which means that rather than I don't know what the correct term with the alternative would be, but Ruby is a message passing language. The idea is that objects receive messages and can choose to respond to those messages one way or the other.
Right.
Whereas in Java, if you try to call a method on an object that doesn't exist, you know, there's not much you can do about it. It doesn't exist. Go away.
Right, so late binding versus compile time binding.
Right, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. So it winds up being a little pub sub like?
Sort of, yeah. I mean, you can do things like check for the existence of a method before calling it and alter your behavior towards an object based on whether or not a particular method exists. So that's known as duck typing. Mm-hmm. So if it based on the phrase, if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it must be a duck.
Right.
And the idea there is that your interfaces are defined by the methods that they implement rather than some formal definition of a particular name, right? Rather than checking whether this thing is a list or whatever, you can check whether or not this object responds to methods that are list-like, which allows you to substitute in objects that adhere to the same contract relatively easily.
Which is super liberal. So let's talk a little bit about that. Steve Yagi recently had a long rant. He's taken a hiatus from blogging for like 4 or 5 years or whatever since he joined Google. And
except for that services rant.
Except for that services rant, yes, about
the
Amazon.
Wonderful, amazing services rant, yes.
and I know Miguel de Casa doesn't think that it's all that useful. He tweeted as such. and tweeted about other things. But I read the whole thing, and yeah, I think it's useful to try and understand where other people are coming from. And if this model of thinking helps you do that, then I think this is a net good. I think he's done a good job with this. So I guess maybe I should explain what he has said, essentially, is that just like in the political world, you have liberals and conservatives, and they don't agree on things, right?
Right.
Sort of fundamental things.
Fundamental outlook on
right,
life,
like
the universe.
Education spending versus war spending, sure. Or whatever, right? And they're just fundamentally different values that they have, right?
Right.
Steve Yagi has taken this as a brain epiphany, he says, and applied it to computer programmers and says that there's liberal and conservative computer programmers, but that has nothing to do with your political outlet. Liberally political sure. people can be conservative coders. It actually has to do with how strict you are on a number of factors. So one of them is, how much do you think types matter? Like, are you a static typing guy or are you a dynamic typing guy? If right. you're dynamic, you're liberal. If you're static, you're conservative. And so the conservative end of the spectrum is provable things like Haskell, functional programming, no mutable state, const correctness in your code, static analysis. Those things are sort of on the conservative bent, whereas the liberal bent for code is duct typing, dynamic typing. He says assembly is the ultimate batshit liberal one, and that's true because I was an assembly writer for a long, long time, and there's no such thing as types. You have ones and zeros, and you interpret them however you want. They're either a number or a double.
I think he defines it as a risk mm-hmm. avoidance thing, right? That conservatives seek to
completely avoid risk at all costs.
Right, have guarantees about what's right. what the behavior right. of a program.
Whereas liberals are like, bugs are going to happen, and it's more important that we be able to respond quickly to them.
Does it get into like code readability conventions versus?
I think those would probably be conservative, because one of the things that he says in the article is about like metaprogramming and templating. So metaprogramming and templating are liberal ideals because right. you can be a C++ expert, and then somebody comes along and defines essentially a domain-specific language using templates within C++, and you look at this thing and you no longer have any idea what it does or how
right.
it does it.
Right.
So you can go from being an expert to a novice in a single line of code. Right. I am an expert C++ programmer. Oh, shit. Somebody's doing something right. funny.
There's this library that I've never heard of that
right.
is suddenly... Yeah.
And so he says that conservative programmers want more than anything to not feel dumb because they've spent a long time becoming experts and masters in their field. And then it is a little disconcerting to me that somebody could come along and write a line of code that would suddenly make me into an idiot.
Right.
Like, I have no idea what this line of code does.
I seem to recall Yagi himself... He describes himself as an unabashed liberal, right?
Yes.
So when he skews his views on conservatives a particular way,
yeah, yeah.
He comes with bias.
Yeah,
attached,
it seems like it comes with baggage.
Yeah.
Right. And so then moderate things are like unit testing, because both conservatives and right. liberals use unit testing. He has a whole list. I guess
code conventions is probably pretty moderate as well, because everyone has their own
yeah.
sort of...
Possibly. He's got his own... He says, like, these are fun to think of, like, what's conservative and
yeah.
what's
right.
Liberal, and that as a fun exercise, but I think it's useful. Sure. I like understanding where other people are coming from.
My worry is that he uses the word conservative kind of like a
yeah,
to hit people with,
yeah.
right.
He definitely does.
But I think it provides a helpful framework. If you're trying to persuade someone to do something, right, to take on your view, it might help you model where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
But it could also poison your view of them, right? If you just dismiss this person as, well, they're conservative, I'm fundamentally liberal, we'll never get along, I'll just ignore them, right?
I'll never understand the need for type systems without general recursion,
right?
Yeah, which is a super conservative, super conservative thing.
And it's obviously the sort of thing that computer programmers and do all the time, right? Is try to beat each other up about you know
right.
Mac, Vim versus
yeah.
Emacs, right? It
yeah.
gets religious
Holy
really
wars.
Quick.
Yeah,
but
it does.
I don't know.
Vim, by the way.
But, yeah, I think we'd all rather avoid that in general. I don't know. I can't imagine that being a productive conversation in the long term.
It seems you mean like the conservative liberal thing is not productive?
It is not productive long term. or even maybe even short term.
So I guess when we labeled ourselves conservative and liberals, it did take something out I'm talking about the politics now.
Right.
In the politics of conservative and liberals, I've always known these terms as long as I've lived, but I sort of understood what each side stood for, but I never understood why they stood for it. And I think when you give people labels, it's a shortcut around why. Right. So
exactly.
I didn't understand why liberals and conservatives believe the things that they believe politically until I saw this amazing TED Talk that essentially explained it. There's these five attributes of morality that we all agree are part of morality, and we all agree on three of them. It's just that these two are higher for conservatives than they are for liberals, and these two are more important for liberals than they are for conservatives. And that explains why, like, we have these fights and why we have the values we have. And that was eye-opening to me. I'm afraid... Yeah. Like, right now, we have a conversation. I'm sorry, I'm talking a lot.
I would love to watch that, though.
It's a great time, yeah.
I'll link it in the show notes. It's fantastic. High openness to new ideals. That is my concern. I'm liberal.
So, when you guys saw his essay, did you immediately jump to one label or another? Do you think of yourselves as conservatives or liberals?
I'm moderate liberal.
Okay.
I don't know. I think my first reaction would be to reject the premise, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think the labels, right now, when you talk about static typing versus dynamic typing, you don't just go, oh, conservatives want static typing, right?
Right.
Instead, you actually go, well, what are the benefits of static
typing?
Right,
I'd rather treat it on its merits.
Right, each topic on its merits. And I do agree with you on that I can concerned that we will lose... Steve Yeagy seems to want to lose the argument between static typing and dynamic typing through the creation of better tools. Said so explicitly, essentially.
Yeah. Right.
Right now, if you have static typing, you have better go to definition, find all references, and better tools around static typing.
Well, in a perfect world, it wouldn't matter, right? And like your dynamic versus static, if your tools were perfect, you wouldn't have to ever worry about it.
Right, and that's what Yeagy is trying to get. He's trying to create a series of tools at Google that will allow you to have as much power over understanding your code in dynamic languages, which is honestly one of my problems with some Python and Ruby is that I look at a class and I didn't write that class. Mm. I have no idea what's available for me to do on that class.
Yeah.
And Google with the Clojure compiler is trying to do things using conventions to...
Right.
Automatically type check and things.
But
with JavaScript, which is a terrible language for trying to write.
That brings me to an interesting place, I think, which is culturally, it seems, it's coming from the outside that Google's conception of how to fix JavaScript is to add types, right? They think that the fundamental problem with JavaScript is that it's not typed.
Typed, but it's not compiled. It's not compilable.
I think it's type checked. So the thing is, like, I've heard this before, that when people go with dynamic languages for a sufficiently large project, and you know much more about test-driven development and testing than I do, when they get to a certain point, they wind up using unit tests essentially to verify that the types are correct, that they have the functions, that they have the parameters that you want.
Sort of. Ideally, tests should be used to specify the behavior of an object rather than its type, I think. Tests that just check for the existence of methods don't tend to add a lot of value. I mean, you can put them there and they might be helpful as documentation, but that's certainly not where I would start if I set out to test a class.
That's a good point. I wasn't sure what they were talking about, of whether it was a test that just said, does it have this function, does it have this, or whether it was a behavioral test that through exercising the behavior actually ensured that the interface was there.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm not sure which they
were talking about. Just called all the functions and checked returns and...
Right.
Okay. Fair enough.
Well, so part of the movement, and we're off on a tangent here again, I apologize, but are you guys familiar with the phrase behavior-driven development?
Yeah, so I love Cucumber and things like that, where you're saying, given a user who is not authorized, who tries to enter the system.
Right.
So Cucumber is written by a guy named Aslak, and I'll try to pronounce his last name, and I'm sure I'll get it wrong, but it's Hellesoy. It's Norwegian, and there's a funky character in there, so I apologize, Aslak, if you're listening. But he used to work at ThoughtWorks, and it's written in a style that we use very commonly for specifying acceptance criteria on story cards. It's, you know, given some condition, was it given when I do something, then it should have some result.
Sure.
But even before there was Cucumber, there was tools like RSpec, and that was considered to be part of the BDD spectrum as well.
Mm-hmm.
And RSpec, as a replacement for unit testing, part of the goal was to sort of get the word test out of it and to get people to start thinking about the behavior of objects rather than correctness.
Right, it's automated specification checking.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
As opposed to testing.
Yeah, and you know, part of the goal of proper TDD is to drive out behavior and help you structure your code correctly and build it into an architecture that's going to be testable and maintainable over time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And BDD winds up looking a lot more like documentation when you're done with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It looks pretty neat.
Right. Whereas TDD just looks like a lot more code.
Yeah. I have a colleague named Olabini who wrote his own programming language. It was called Aoki, which is a beautiful programming language. It was wonderful. And he set out to write the world's most expressive programming language. He wanted something that would basically give you an instant DSL. And he very specifically, at least in the early stages, said, I will not be optimizing this for performance,
mm-hmm.
Which I thought was always a pity, because if he had started optimizing it for performance, then all the time I invested learning it would have paid out more in the end.
Right.
But
Just ride Moore's Law, man.
You just guaranteed that 90% of people will never touch it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, how's it perform? Poorly. Well, all right. Yeah, we'll be checking out that. But anyway, I learned a lot by doing it. And he made a choice about documentation early on that I thought was really interesting. And his premise was that a method was not public. Well, the publicness of a method was determined by whether or not it had tests. A method was considered part of the public API if you had written, I should say, specs for it, and it was private if you had no specs. So in order to have your method appear as part of the public documentation for the module you were writing, you had to test it. I just thought it was an interesting idea.
That is an interesting idea. Cool. I kind of like that. Huh. Actually, yeah, let's talk more about TDD and BDD. You're actually the first guest that we've had on who actually has done this.
I've done it religiously for years and years.
How did you become so religious?
I started out so in the comp sci program I studied at actually emphasized unit testing, but it was
really in school.
In school, yeah, but it wasn't nice. Test driven. It was part of a recipe that involved, well, you should think really hard about your program and then write your code, and then at the end, just to make sure, write a bunch of tests. And it was only when I got to ThoughtWorks that I got introduced to this XP mindset, which was very focused on test-driven development as a way of life.
Mm-hmm.
And I've gone back and forth on it, and I'll often write personal code that I don't TDD. If I'm just doing something for fun, I'll throw code at the wall, sure. But when I'm writing production code, I tend to think that for lots of problems, it's a very, very, very powerful tool for helping me understand what I'm writing and communicate about that code to my colleagues.
Hmm.
And particularly at ThoughtWorks, which is a consultancy, and people tend to rotate back and forth between code bases and projects, you have to be able to communicate with people who have not seen that code base before what a particular class or module is doing and give them the ability to make changes to it safely. And one thing
with
that...
With confidence.
Yeah. I should say with confidence.
Right.
And one thing that tests do marvelously is give you a kind of safety net. You can make a change to a class, and as long as that area of the code base is reasonably well tested and you're working with people who are reasonably disciplined about what they're doing, you can do it with some level of confidence that you haven't brought the site down, right?
Mm-hmm.
It provides you with a marvelous ability to play with your code and refactor it and improve it as a piece without being worried that everything's going to fall apart. So actually, to come back to the conservative and liberal conversation, I tend to think now of unit testing and static typing or strong typing sort of occupying opposite ends of that spectrum.
Okay.
And I know you do both in Java, maybe it's not the best example in the world, but I've heard people in Haskell claim that you don't really need tests.
If your type system's cracked.
Right, yeah.
I've heard this too.
Yeah.
I don't understand it. There's like huge mathematical notation about this. I don't understand.
I mean, if what you're doing is business process modeling, like many of us do, then I think it's hogwash. But I don't know what the hell I'm talking about.
So. Yeah, I for business process modeling, I still want just flowcharts that are executable, which is actually the first project that I worked on at Microsoft.
We've tried that before as an industry, right?
We've tried on that path. Many times. IBM failed. I failed at Microsoft. I think for 60 years or so, this has been failed. Model-driven development is sort of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Holy grail, yet utter failure.
Drawing arrows. Exactly. That's the only book, I think, Martin Fowler, at least as far as I know, he's stated that he thinks might not have been the best contribution to the world, is that he wrote an entire book on UML.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote it because his publisher asked him to. And I would say that if you asked him now, he would probably tell you not to use UML to specify code. As a way of diagramming, certainly, but for the love of God, don't try to compile it.
Yeah, there are certain diagrams in there. Like I actually like the user story diagrams and things like that, or the communication back and forth diagrams. I even like RDBMS diagrams. I like those a lot.
Sure.
But outside of that, class diagrams, I'm not sure.
I mean, there's this notion, I think, in enterprise IT for a while, there was this hope that you could just hire one very smart architect and he could draw a bunch of diagrams for you and hand them off to some lackey and say, here, you know, I've designed it, now just go write it. And we've walked into a lot of companies where that's been the prevailing wisdom, and it tends not to work at all, ever. Mm,
yeah.
It tends to result in a bit of a disaster.
But it does seem like TDD works.
Yes. It's interesting, right? I mean, part of the premise, I think, with TDD is that you are investing your code with quality. And there are times in which it's very important to invest your code with quality. If you're reasonably sure that what you're writing is the right thing.
Without impacting flexibility.
Right, yeah.
Agility, yeah.
Yeah. But tests are code, right? And tests are interesting because once you have enough of them, they tend to take on a life of their own. They have inertia.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you think twice about changing something.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to say is, have you ever not changed something because rewriting all those tests would be annoying?
I have, yeah.
Okay.
I think that tends to be indicative to me of a team that's not put enough effort into treating the tests as first-class parts of the code base, as things which are refactorable and can be aided with the use of DSLs and helper methods and things that really pull you in the direction of more maintainable tests.
I think that's the distinction for me, is that I've never worked on a team that treated tests as first-class citizens of the code, right? We've written plenty of unit tests, we've tested things, we've implemented testing frameworks, but it's always been, you know, the first thing to go when you're in a hurry.
Yeah, sure.
I think this isn't possibly the same reason like people smoke today, even though they realize that it will kill them someday. Like smokers know it will kill them, and yet they do it anyway. I think programmers have a similar thing when it comes to not writing tests or not doing these things.
Eating your vegetables.
Yeah, the result is so far off in the future. Once again, programmers need immediate feedback.
Right. And that's hugely important, right? I don't think you can underestimate the impact of immediate feedback. And
well, that's why we've been talking about visualization of code so much, right? Is because everyone loves to say, "Look at this thing I made."
Yeah.
Even in your head, you love to say to yourself, "See this thing I made." That there's a universal human joy in that, and you know, and
it's the craft. It's the making of things, right?
It's the creation.
Show off to your friends, and yeah, and writing unit tests is not nearly as much fun.
Hey, look, this is green.
Yeah.
Yay.
When I was off in the wilderness a few months back and just kind of doing my own thing for a little while, I set out to write a piece of open source code. And I'd come out of ThoughtWorks and decided I wanted to throw out all the rules. And I just said, screw this. I'm not going to write tests for any of this stuff. I'll just go forward and it'll be fine. And it worked fine up until a point where I had to write, I don't know, some sort of XML munger. And it reminded me, like I banged my head on it and screwed around with it until I finally realized that I should probably just, for the love of God, set up a testing framework and just go at it. And it made the process so much simpler. Once you're comfortable with unit testing or test-driven development as a way of life, it makes so many problems just vastly simpler. If you're relatively sure that you know what you're doing and you just need to have some sense of progress as you go, it makes certain kinds of otherwise difficult problems stupid simple.
Mm-hmm.
And so I still, you know, it's revalidated my value of that technique.
Can you enumerate some of the problems that it makes stupid simple?
I mean, it allows you to build in small pieces, right? And everyone, you know, I think tends to agree that building in small pieces is a good way to build something large and complex.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I used to intern at IBM, and a programmer I worked with there, a senior architect, said something. He was, I think, disgusted with the problem we were working on, because IBM was trying to build a vast piece of application, a vast WebSphere. Framework. Yeah, something else. It was built on layers of WebSphere. It was like WebSphere and then WebSphere Portal Server and then some god-awful other thing, you know, crufted on top of that. And the I don't think this is original to him, but his quote was that every successful big system started as a successful small system.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is where test-driven development is most effective. You start with the simplest, dumbest possible thing you could possibly do, and you build up from there. And as you go and as you get more complex, at every step in the journey, you know that everything you wrote before you still works, right?
You didn't have a solid foundation.
Yeah, you didn't make some stupid mistake and suddenly break your test case from, you know, half an hour ago. Everything's still okay. And that allows you, as long as you're being disciplined about testing your code from an interface point of view, it allows you to change the implementation and clean things up and refactor as you go and not trip over yourself in the process, at least in an ideal world.
That's interesting because that's also sort of the Unix philosophy too, of small tools that do something and then you just pipe them all together.
Yeah.
I was about to say this sounds like Functional Programming Manifesto 2 in a way.
Small units
of
code.
Small units, yeah. Putting everything together, linking it all, the little pieces of code that all work together.
I mean, there's a zen of functional programming that I hope to achieve someday. I mean, I think that there's a lot in that. I always struggled with Scheme because I couldn't figure out how you could build such large systems from such small functions.
Right.
And I remember when I first when I first learned Java in school, this is going to sound crazy, but I loved Java. I loved that you could build these marvelous architectural castles in the sky. And there were all these sort of grand classes that had so much functionality and they interlinked with each other in interesting ways. It was so fun building these structures out of almost Legos, and Scheme seemed so piddling in comparison. But as I've grown older, I've come to appreciate this notion of building things in small pieces a lot more. And I especially have enjoyed working with Clojure and its approach to building out modules and exposing only certain pieces of that. I mean, I think the way that Clojure modules communicate with each other connects a lot of the dots for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure Scheme has a similar framework, similar functionality. I just never made it far enough into the community to get to the really interesting stuff.
Hmm. Do you have any recommendation for people who want to become familiar with test-driven development, but right now their office is not paying them to write tests?
I hate that argument that they're not being paid to write tests. I mean, it's you know, I know that's automatically the first thing that people jump to. But it's such a good way to write code, period. I don't want to be fanatical about it. I'm not arguing for unreserved, constant. There are people
that... Be fanatical. You're the first one on the show.
But where would you start if you had to... If you were teaching someone, if you were teaching
a class?
Would you
start BDD?
I would probably start... I mean, I'm a Ruby guy, and I love RSpec. RSpec changed the way I thought about testing. It really improved my understanding. So I'd probably start with a relatively simple example and build out from there. I think actually simple data structures are a good demonstration of the power of the technique. You know more or less what you want to produce. You know more or less what the behavior should be. If you're trying to build your own linked list or something, right? Presumably you have a textbook handy that explains to you what the correct behavior should be. But you can use specifications to build out that behavior as you go, and be reasonably assured that by the end of it, you'll have something that behaves as you expect it to. And I'm sure that there are type systems you could erect in Haskell or similar that would provide you with similar levels of certainty.
Of assuredness, yeah.
Yeah, I can't really speak to that except to say that I believe it. You know, I'm sure that those guys know what they're talking about. But if you're working in a more dynamic language, or even if you're working in something like Java, which does not have a type system that's anywhere near that effective, then going at it in a TDD style, starting with a single method and saying, well, what's the base case for this method? If I want to check for whether or not my list is empty, write a simple test for is empty and do the dumbest possible thing. The test should say a new list should be empty, and then you write an implementation of is empty that returns true. Right. And then literally, you know, the next dumbest thing you can possibly get. That being said, I was pairing with Martin Feller last year. I was living in Melbourne, Australia, and ThoughtWorks hosted the Global Day of Code Retreat, which is sort of a code craftsmanship movement that encourages people to iterate over a single problem, pair with different people during the course of the day, work on this problem, and then sort of try it in different ways. And I'd been facilitating in Melbourne, and Martin Feller sort of sweeps in at the end of the day, and he's wandering around and hemming and hawing and looking at what people are doing. He does that. He's a marvelous hemmer and hawer. He's got this big beard and just sort of, you know, grunts and asks people what they're up to. Finally, at the end of the day, he and I ended up pairing on the problem on the big screen. And I was going at it in a very didactic way, since I wanted to be a good example, which shows you how ridiculous I am, I guess. But we finally get to a point where we really didn't know where to go with the next step. And Martin said, "Well, just solve the fucking problem. just you know, let's stop with this dicking around with simple test cases and just write the code. We know what the code should look like. Let's write the code." So there you go.
All right. Well, great. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on. You guys have some marvelous guests here. I'm not sure how I made it onto the invite list, but thank you very much. It's a wonderful show.
Awesome. Great to have you. Thanks, Brian.
Yeah.
Thanks. Bye, everybody.
Bye.